I surprised myself by thinking of these creatures in human terms, but over the following days, as we rode south towards Thebes, I discovered that they could be stupid or clever, suspicious or trusting, dour or mischievous, friendly or aloof, brave or timid, nervous or phlegmatic, long-suffering or impatient, surprising or predictable, in short, as close to man in temperament as any creature that walks on four legs. The more I learned about them, the more I wanted to learn. The longer I spent working with them, the more I grew to love them. I rode ahead on Patience, her foal at heel. The herd trailed after us compliantly, all 316 of them. Huey brought up the rear to sweep up any stragglers. With each league we covered, I became more confident and proficient upon Patience's back, and the rapport between us became firmer. The mare became an extension of my own body, but so much swifter and stronger than my own feeble limbs. It felt so natural and right to be astride that broad and sturdy back that I was amazed that so few others were willing to share the experience with me. Perhaps it was not only the terror that had struck them so devastatingly on the plain of Abnab, but also the words and attitude of Tunnus, Lord Harab, that affected the regiments of our army. Whatever the reason, I could find no Egyptian who would mount upon the back of a horse except Huey, and very much later Prince Memnon. Of course, they learned to husband and breed the horse and care for him. Under my tutelage, they became dexterous and dashing charioteers, but I never saw a man of them mounted on horseback, save only myself and Huey and the prince. When the chariots that I would design with their light-spoked wheels swept all before them and made Egypt the master of this creation, Tanos never followed our example, and I never heard him express a kind sentiment towards those willing and brave animals who dragged him into battle. Even in later years, when the horse was commonplace through all our realm, it was considered somehow indecent and obscene to mount them. When the three of us rode past astride, many of the common people spat on the ground three times and made the signal against the evil eye. But all that was in the future, as I led my herd up the west bank of the river towards Thebes, and we arrived to the gratitude of my mistress and to a gruff and unenthusiastic welcome from the commander-in-chief of the Egyptian armies. "Just keep those evil brutes out of my sight," Tunnus told me. He still had not forgiven me for going above him to my mistress. In fairness to him, he had more than enough excuse for his evil temper. The safety of the state and our nation were in the direst jeopardy. There had never been a time in our history when our civilization was so threatened by the barbarian. Already Asyut was lost, and the whole east bank of the river as far as Dendera. Completely undaunted and undeterred by the naval reverse that Tanus had inflicted upon him, King Salatis, with his chariots, had swept on and surrounded the walled city of Thebes. Those walls should have withstood siege for a decade, but that reckoned without the baleful presence of Lord Intef in the camp of the enemy. It transpired that while still Grand Vizier of the Upper Kingdom, he had secretly ordered the construction of a concealed passage beneath the city walls. Even I, who knew most of his other secrets, had never suspected this, and Lord Intef had murdered the workman who had carried out this construction, so that he alone was aware of its existence. I have no idea why he should have constructed the tunnel in the first place, except that his devious mind was much given towards such devices. The palace was riddled with trapdoors and concealed corridors, like the warren of a rabbit or the lair of a desert fox. When Lord Intef disclosed its existence to him, King Salatus sent a small party of his best men through the secret passage, and once within the walls they stormed the unsuspecting Egyptian guards on the main gate, slaughtered them, and threw the gates wide open. The main Hyksos horde poured into the city, and within days of the siege commencing, the city was lost and half her inhabitants massacred. From the west bank, where Tanos now had his headquarters in the half-built palace of Memnon, we could see the burnt and blackened roofs of those buildings in the city across the river that the Hyksos had put to the torch. Each day we watched the dust clouds of their chariots as they raced up and down the far bank, and the glint of their spearheads at the shoulder slope as they prepared for the battle that all of us knew was coming. With his sadly depleted fleet, Tanos had thus far managed to hold the river line, and during my absence had beaten back another attempt by the Hyksos to get across the Nile in strength. However, our defences were thinly spread, for we had to guard a great sweep of the river, while the Hyksos could make a crossing at any point they chose. We learned from our spies on the east bank that they had commandeered every single craft they could lay their hands on, from barge to skiff, They had captured many of our boatmakers and had them at work in the boatyards of Thebes. Of course, we could be sure that Lord Intef would give them pertinent advice in all these matters, for he must have been every bit as eager as the barbarian Salatus to seize Pharaoh's treasure. The crews of our galleys stood to arms every watch of the day and night, and Tanos only slept when he could, which was not often. Neither my mistress nor I saw much of him, and when we did, he was haggard and short-tempered. Every night saw the arrival on the west bank of many hundreds of refugees. Of both sexes and all ages, they crossed the Nile in an odd assortment of rafts and small craft. Many of the stronger ones even swam the wide stretch of water. All of them were desperate to escape the Hyksos terror. They brought us horror stories of rapine and plunder, but also detailed and up-to-date news of Hyksos movements. Of course, we welcomed these people. They were countrymen and relatives, but their numbers strained our resources. Our main granaries had all been in Thebes, and most of the herds of cattle and sheep had fallen into the hands of the enemy. Queen Lostris gave me the responsibility of gathering up all the supplies of grain and the herds on the west bank. I drew up lists and rosters for rationing our supplies of meat and grain. Fortunately, the date palms were in full bearing, and the supply of fish from the river was inexhaustible. The Hyksos could never starve us out. My mistress had also appointed me master of the royal horse. There was no intense competition for this appointment, particularly as no pay or privileges were attached to it. I made Huey my deputy, and he managed by means of bribes, threats, and blackmail to recruit 100 grooms to help him care for our little herd. Later we would train them as our first chariot drivers. It was no hardship for me to make time every day to visit our makeshift stables in the necropolis. The mare Patience always came running to greet me, and I carried corn cakes for her and her foal. Often I was able to sneak Prince Memnon away from his mother and his nurses, and carry him into the stables on my shoulders. He squealed with excitement as soon as he saw the horses. I held the prince on my lap as Patience and I galloped along the river bank, and he made clucking noises and rocked his little backside, imitating the way in which I urged Patience to a harder gallop. I made certain that the route we followed on these rides would never cross Tanos' path. He had still not forgiven me, and if he had seen his son on the back of a cursed horse, I knew that I would have been in physical danger. I also spent a great deal of my time in the armory workshop of Pharaoh's funerary temple, where I had the assistance of some of the finest craftsmen in the world to help me build my first chariot. It was here, while working on the design of these vehicles, that I conceived devices that were to become our first line of defence against the Hyksos chariots. These were simply long wooden staves sharpened at both ends, and with the points fire-hardened. Each of our infantrymen would carry 10 of these in a bundle upon his back. At the approach of a squadron of cavalry, the staves were planted in the earth at an angle, with the points at the level of the horses' chests. Our men took up their positions behind this barrier of wicked spears and fired their arrows over them. When I demonstrated these to Tanos, he threw his arm around my shoulders for the first time since our quarrel over the horses and said, "Well, at least you've not turned senile on me yet." And I knew that I had been at least partially forgiven. The ground that I had gained with him here was almost completely lost over the affair of the Taita chariot. My workmen and I at last completed the first chariot. The dashboard and sides were of split bamboo woven into basketwork. The axle was of acacia wood. The hubs were of hand-forged bronze, greased with mutton fat, and the spoked wheels were bound with bronze rims. It was so light that two charioteers could lift it between them, and carry it over broken ground where the horses could not pull it. Even I realized that it was a masterpiece, and the workmen called it the Taita chariot. I did not object to the name. Huey and I harnessed up two of our best horses, Patience and Blade, and took the Taita chariot for its first gallop. It took us some time to learn how to control the rig, but we learned swiftly, and the horses were bred to this and showed us the way. In the end, we were flying across the ground and hurtling through tight turns at full gallop. When we drove back into the stables, flushed with excitement and jubilant with our achievement, both of us were convinced that our chariot was swifter and handier than any that the Hyksos could send against us. We tested and modified this creation of mine for 10 full days, working by lamplight in the armory until the late watches of every night, before I was satisfied that I could show it to Tanos. Thanos came to the stables with surly reluctance, and balked at climbing up into the cockpit of the chariot behind me. "I trust this contraption of yours as much as I trust those cursed brutes who tow it," he grumbled. But I was persuasive, and at last he stepped up gingerly onto the footplate, and we were off. At first I kept the horses to an easy trot, until I felt him relaxing, and despite himself beginning to enjoy the exhilarating ride. Then I pushed them into a canter. "See the speed of it. You can be upon the enemy before he knows you are there," I exulted. Thanos laughed for the first time, and I was encouraged. "With your ships you rule the river, with this chariot you rule the land. Between the two you rule the world. Nothing can stand against you." I was careful not to disparage his beloved ships or to make unfavourable comparisons. "Is this your best speed?" he shouted in the wind and the pounding of the hooves. "With a fair wind, Breath of Horus is faster than this," which was a lie and a challenge. "Hold on to the sides and take a deep breath," I warned him. "I am going to take you up where the eagles fly." And I let patience and blade go. No man has ever travelled faster. The wind seared our eyes, and the tears pouring from them were blown back into our hair. "Sweet breath of Isis," Thanos shouted with excitement. "This is..." I never knew what he thought this was. Thanos never finished his sentence, for at that instant our off-wheel hit a rock and the rim exploded. The chariot capsized and somersaulted, and both Thanos and I were thrown high and clear. I struck the hard earth with a force that should have crippled me, but I was so concerned with how Thanos would be affected by this little mishap, and how my dreams and plans would be dashed, that I felt no pain. I bounded to my feet and saw Thanos crawl to his bleeding knees 20 paces beyond me. He was coated heavily with dust, and seemed to have lost the skin from one half of his face. He tried to maintain his dignity as he pushed himself upright and staggered back to the wrecked chariot, but he was limping heavily. He stood for a long minute gazing down at the shattered ruins of my creation. And then abruptly he let out a roar like a wounded bull, and launched such a mighty kick at it that it flipped over again, as though it were a child's toy. He turned on his heel without even a glance in my direction and limped away. I did not see him again for a week, and when we did meet, neither of us mentioned the chariot. I think that might have been the end of the matter, and we would never have assembled our first chariot squadron if it had not been for the fact that the stubbornness of my mistress's pride surpassed even that of her lover. She had given me the original order and would not now retract it. When Thanos tried to inveigle her into doing so, he merely made my position stronger. Yui and I rebuilt the chariot within 3 days, and another identical to it. By the time the embalmers in the funerary chapel had completed the ritual 70 days of royal mummification, we had our first squadron of 50 chariots, and had trained drivers for them. Since we had returned to the Palace of Memnon from our defeat at the Battle of Abnab, my mistress had been occupied with the business of state thrust upon her by the Regency. Long hours were spent with her ministers and advisers. It was now that the initial training which I had given her in the Palace of Elephantine was to bear fruit. I had taught her to pick her way unerringly through the labyrinth of power and influence. She was just 21 years of age, but she was a queen, and ruled like one. Very occasionally she encountered a problem which particularly vexed or perplexed her. Then she sent for me. I would drop my work in the armoury or the stables or in the small scribery that she had set aside for me just down the corridor from her audience chamber, and I would rush to her side. On occasion I spent days sitting below her throne and steering her through some troublesome decisions. Once again my ability to read the lips of men without hearing their words stood us in good stead. Some nobleman at the back of the audience never realized, as he plotted or schemed with his neighbour, that I was relaying his exact words to my mistress. She swiftly acquired a reputation of sagacity and prescience. Neither of us enjoyed much rest during these dark and worrisome days. Even though our days were full, our nights were long. Those interminable councils of war and of state lasted well past midnight. No sooner was one crisis averted than another loomed before us. Each day the Hyksos threatened us more directly, and Thanos' hold on the river line weakened. Slowly a sense of doom and despair permeated all of us. Men smiled little and never laughed out loud. Even the play of the children was muted and subdued. We had only to look across the river, and the enemy was there, gathering himself, growing stronger each day.